mind that I requested your interview." The grin was uncannily familiar. "I was curious who my little brother has a crush on." She had no idea how to respond, so she didn't. The word crush was an invigorating jolt, but this easily ranked as one of the worst ways to meet a potential boyfriend's family. She'd been praying for any other officer. Chris, McConney decided to think of him as Chris rather than Officer Larson, because it was moderately less intimidating, led her to an empty room filled with electric typewriters. It was the keyboarding classroom. Freshmen were taught on typewriters because it was too easy to cheat on computers. Copy and paste. Chris gestured to the hard orange chair that was stationed beside the teacher's desk. McConney sat down obediently. The buzzing fluorescent lights were so harsh and stark for a room that felt so neglected and out of time. They made her feel naked. She crossed her arms, worried that it looked disrespectful, and then sat on her hands instead. Chris rolled the comfortable teacher's chair toward her and took a seat. He examined her appearance, not unkindly. "How are you holding up?" McConney knew she didn't look right. She looked twitchy and disturbed. It was better to admit it and hope that he assumed it was for normal reasons. "Not great."
"Yeah, I hear you. Everyone's shaken up pretty bad, even us," he said,
and she assumed he meant the police.
"We've never seen anything like this in Osborne. Have your teachers given you the information about counseling?"
Ollie had been so good with her grandmother, yet here she was completely failing with his brother. She'd spoken two words and could barely look at him, and he already thought she needed counseling. Still, all she could do was nod. At least it was true. Every teacher had given them the information. The counselors would be slammed for months.
"Good. That's good."
Chris removed a flippable notepad from his breast pocket and clicked a pen to the ready.
"Now, I just have a few questions. They're totally standard. We're asking everyone."
Another nod. Her hands began to sweat underneath her jeans. His voice remained friendly, though it grew a touch sterner, cop voice.
"I know you're new around here, but were you acquainted with either of the victims?"
It was a peculiar thing. McConney had lived here for almost a year, plenty of time to have gotten to know the victims. But in a town like this, she would always be made to feel like the new girl. "No," she said. "I've never spoken to Haley." "I've never spoken," instead of "I never spoke," as if there were still a chance that they might bump into each other buying iced mochas at the gas station. She adjusted her verbs. "Maybe I spoke to Matt once or twice in government class, because he sat near me, but I'm not even sure. If I did, it wasn't memorable." The interrogation continued.
"Do you know anyone the victims might have had trouble with? Were they ever bullied? Did they ever bully someone else?"
McConney answered each question in the negative, wondering how many of her classmates had possessed the audacity to mention Ollie. They would have all known that they were talking to his brother, same last name, similar appearance, infamous car. Sergeant Beamer had interviewed Ollie during lunch. Ollie hadn't told McConney much, only that it had taken the entire hour. Everybody else's interviews had taken just a few minutes. Was Ollie questioned about the episode with Matt in the quad? And had there been other episodes before it? "Sorry," McConney shrugged at the industrial linoleum. "I'm not much help. I don't hang out with either of their crowds."
"That's okay. Everything helps."
His tone had softened and she looked up. Having successfully nabbed her attention, he broke into a mischievous smile.
"Where were you yesterday between the hours of 6 and 7 p.m?"
Her cheeks exploded with heat. His grin widened. "I was with your brother."
Makani cringed and crossed her arms. He drove me home at 6:30, and then I made dinner with my grandma.
And where had Ali driven you?
She moaned somewhat dramatically.
Might I remind you that I'm an officer of the law?
He was flat out teasing her, so Makani steeled herself with a wry, defeated smile. I honestly don't know. It was some random cornfield off 275, between here and Troy. We made out. He got a call from work, and then we left. Chris made another notation on his notepad. Makani sat up a bit straighter. Why? What did he say?
Same thing. He looked pleased with himself. I just wanted to hear you say it.
She actually laughed, which made him laugh too. Can I go now? Is this over? He waved for her to remain seated.
Almost.
Makani rebraced in anticipation of the inevitably awkward next question. What are your intentions with my brother? Which she would not answer, so she was caught off guard when Chris asked,
How much hunting experience do you have?
None. Her brow furrowed. My dad used to take me fishing sometimes, but I was never really into it. Does that count?
Did you ever help him gut the fish?
No.
How much experience would you say that you have with a knife?
The blood drained from Akani's face. Why would you ask me that? Chris looked up from scribbling. He cocked his head.
Because the person we're trying to find has a certain level of skill with a knife and knowledge of anatomy.
No. Her voice trembled. No. Thankfully, he must have jumped to the conclusion that she was upset by the reason for the question rather than the question itself.
You're okay, he assured her, tucking away his notepad. That's all we needed to know.
Her heart was racing as he led her back into the hallway.
I still have to interview the administrators, but at least you get to go home soon, huh?
Chris held out his hand.
Until we meet again.
Makani shook it. She wanted to say that it was nice to meet him. Instead, she rushed into the restroom. She was already crying as she burst into the first stall, not for a specific reason, but for all of them. She wished that she were in Hawaii, having a normal senior year. She wished that she could have been the appropriate blend of charming and sad for Chris. She wished that there weren't psychopaths who killed for pleasure and made the world feel unsafe. She wished that Ali were her boyfriend and that she could make out with him again, preferably as soon as possible. And she wished that she weren't so selfish to wish for a boyfriend when two of her classmates were dead. If she stayed here any longer, people might wonder. Makani swallowed her tears, dried her face with a scratchy paper towel, and exited the bathroom. Ali was leaning against the wall beside the drinking fountains. His eyes were dark with under-eye circles.
You got my brother. It wasn't a question.
Officer Larson requested me specifically. Ali sighed. It was fine. It was nice. Makani glanced around, but the hallway was empty. Were you waiting for me? And then she noticed her backpack on the floor near his feet. Why do you have that?
I asked Signora Washington if I could use the bathroom. She didn't even notice when I grabbed our bags. I saw you go inside, so I waited.
She'd been in there for over 10 minutes. Panic floated to the surface, instantly accessible. I was sitting, just sitting. I didn't want to go back to class. Ali nodded. You should have knocked, she said. He raised his eyebrows. They both knew that he would never have dared to knock on the door to the women's restroom. Too many potential embarrassing outcomes. No, sorry. Makani was exhausted and confused. None of this was making any sense. But why do you have my bag?
Are you okay? He asked.
What? She shook her head. It was like they were having two different conversations.
No, I'm not okay. Are you okay?
Ali smiled.
Not at all.
Makani stared back at him until she erupted with helpless laughter. Tears returned to the corners of her eyes.
I have no idea. What's happening?
There are still 20 minutes until the final bell, but I'm leaving now. Ali picked up her backpack and held it out. Want a ride? Chapter 9. The only people who noticed their early departure were the reporters. They hovered like vultures between the campus and parking lot, waiting for the students to be let out for the weekend, waiting for carrion. As Makani and Ali neared, Makani's spine stiffened. She lowered her head and walked faster. Ali adjusted his speed to match. The reporters erupted all at once.
Did you know the victims? How would you describe the atmosphere inside the school today? Will this hurt your team's chances in the playoffs?
Microphones and cameras were jammed in their direction, and Makani angled her body away from the intrusion in the clearest possible signal, but a woman with a wall of hairsprayed bangs chased behind them anyway.
How does it feel to have lost two of your classmates in only 3 days?
Makani focused on Ali's car at the far end of the lot.
How does it feel to have lost two of your classmates in 3 days?
Car, 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 car. A hand touched Makani's shoulder and she screamed. Her eyes looked manic with fright. The reporter stumbled backward into her cameraman, and Makani screamed again. The woman exclaimed something in confused anger, and suddenly Ali stood between them, shouting,
"Get away from her! Get the fuck away from her!"
The cameraman placed a hand on the reporter's arm, urging her back, but she wasn't ready to yield.
"You," she said, "pink hair. How does it feel? How the fuck do you think it feels?"
The cameraman pleaded with the reporter. "They're probably minors." Through the haze, Ali reached for Makani. An arm slid around her back as he hustled her toward his car. Car, 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 she thought. Car. He opened the passenger's door, helped her inside, and ran to the driver's side. All five of her senses were overloading. Instead of trying not to cry, Makani just tried not to sob. She expected, maybe even wanted, him to tear out of the lot, but he exited cautiously and stuck to the speed limit. He turned left, away from the direction of her house, and drove until they reached the park near the elementary school. The cruiser pulled over to a stop. Makani felt him trying to decide whether or not to lay a comforting hand on her arm.
"I'm sorry," she said.
Her overreaction was blatant and humiliating. She had to lie.
"I don't know why."
"You don't have anything to apologize for." She sniffled, rummaging through her backpack for tissues. Ali leaned over her to pop open the glove compartment. It was lined with crumpled napkins from an out-of-town KFC. She accepted a wad and blew her nose. There was no attractive way to do it. She felt like a monster.
"It's been such a shitty day."
"Such a shitty day." He laughed once. They sat in silence for a full minute. Makani stared out the window. The park was empty apart from a mom and toddler on the swings.
"I don't want to go home."
Her voice was weak and dispirited. "She'll want me to rehash everything that happened at school today.
But I don't want to talk about it. I can't think about it anymore."
Ali nodded. He understood that she was talking about her grandmother.
"Where would you like to go?"
"Someplace quiet." So, Ali took her to his house. It was a 20-minute drive.
halfway between Osborne and East Bend on Highway 79. Another lonely road of cornfields and cattle ranches. Every mile they'd pass another highlighter yellow billboard for the Martin Family Fun Corn Maze. A smiling family of cartoon redheads beamed at them from the top corner of each advertisement. Nebraska's largest corn maze! 5 miles ahead! Pumpkin patch! 4 miles ahead! Hay rides! 3 miles ahead! Petting zoo! 2 miles ahead! Corn pit! 1 mile ahead!
What's a corn pit?
Makani already felt lighter, knowing that she had a few hours' respite ahead of her. She'd texted Darby that Ollie was driving her home, and she'd texted Grandma Young that Darby was taking her to his house. Neither seemed pleased, but they'd each correctly assumed that she needed a distraction from the news.
"Exactly what it sounds like," Ollie said. "A giant pit of corn kernels."
"Okay. But what does one do with a corn pit?"
He glanced at her with a smile.
"You know, those ball pits at McDonald's? It's like that, but bigger, a lot bigger."
"It's pretty fun," he admitted.
"Now, the petting zoo, that's what I could do without. When the wind blows just right."
Makani laughed as circus-like flags appeared through the fields. They passed the sprawling maze and a massive dirt parking lot, which was mostly vacant.
"Does anyone actually come here?"
"It's packed on the weekends. People drive in from Omaha and Lincoln. And it's loud. You can hear it in my house. On Saturdays, they even have a polka band. When our windows are open, I'll often find my feet tapping to the belch of their tuba."
She laughed again. "I'm still imagining you swimming in the corn pit." Ollie kept his eyes ahead, but they twinkled, or maybe gleamed. He turned onto the next road. A gentle hill broke up the flatness of the surrounding earth. It was the hushed, eerie beauty of Willa Cather country a century later. Sophomore year she'd been assigned to read O Pioneers in English class, and the familiar descriptions of the land had comforted her. They'd reminded her of visiting her favorite grandmother. Little did she know that soon enough she'd be living here. The novel no longer held any appeal. It wasn't fictional anymore. A house in the distance grew bigger, and Makani realized that the road was Ollie's driveway. His house was white, like hers, but peeling and weather-worn. It was a Victorian Gothic revival, a style that was growing obsolete in these parts, with three dramatically arched windows under three steeply pitched roof points. Twin columns framed a modest covered porch. The expansive yard was unkempt and overgrown. Makani was grateful that she didn't believe in ghosts. She only believed in the ghost-like quality of painful memories. And she was sure this house had plenty. Not everything about it was gloomy, however. As she stepped out of the car, a set of wind chimes jangled in the breeze, and two large ferns swayed on chains from opposite ends of the porch. They were dead from the early frosts, but proof of recent habitation. Ollie shot her a nervous glance.
"Home, sweet home."
Had he ever brought home a girl before, or was this something new for him? Something potentially vulnerable. On the disintegrating choir welcome mat, a single word was barely visible. Larson. The younger Larson unlocked the front door, which opened into a large, dim, and dusty room.
"I know," he sighed. "It looks like a haunted house."
Makani held up two innocent hands. "I didn't say a word." He led her inside with a tight smile. The floors were old hardwood, and the boards groaned with each step. Makani waited in the threshold while Ollie threw open the curtains. Sparkling dust motes caught in the sudden light as the living room was revealed to be more homelike, more normal than anticipated. She couldn't help feeling relieved. The rugs, lamps, and hardware seemed to be a mixture of Victorian reproductions and actual Victorian antiques, but the sectional sofa was firmly from this century. Though there was something about the space. It possessed an unnatural amount of stillness. Everything appeared unruffled, unused.
"Would you like something to drink?" Ollie asked. "We have water, orange juice, Coke. Well, it's not Coca-Cola. It's the off-brand Coke."
McConney laughed because he'd remembered. "Water's fine."
"Tap water? Ice? No ice?"
She trailed behind him through the adjoining dining room, which was also murky and untouched. Ollie moved like a creature of habit. "Whichever's more work for you," she called out, even though the temperature inside wasn't much warmer than it had been outside. She didn't want ice. At least the kitchen was brighter, much brighter. Curtainless windows looked out upon the sweeping fields, and the maze's flags waved merrily in the distance. Ollie's kitchen, though not as clean as Grandma Young's, was less dusty than the other rooms, and the dishes had been recently washed and were drying on a rack. And while the cabinetry and furniture didn't look exactly modern, they didn't look Victorian, either. A shadow lurched out from the floorboards. McConney shrieked as a small dog with a speckled bluish-gray coat skittered and stumbled toward Ollie. Laughing, he kneeled to greet the intruder.
"Hey, Squidward!"
For the second time in an hour, she'd completely lost her shit. McConney felt embarrassed all over again. "Sorry, I didn't know you had a dog."
"Blue Heeler."
Ollie smiled as he rubbed its head.
"Back when we adopted him, I was a big SpongeBob fan. Now he's deaf and almost blind. He sleeps most of the day. That's why he didn't notice when we came in."
Squidward leaned against him as if he were using Ollie to keep himself upright.
"How are you, buddy?"
McConney squatted to pet him. "Is he friendly?"
"If you let him sniff your hand first, you'll be fine."
Squidward himself kind of smelled, but McConney didn't mind. His fur was coarse, almost waxy, but it felt nice to be petting a dog and even nicer to be this close to Ollie.
"Do you have a dog back home?"
Ollie looked aside as he added this second question, aware of how infrequently she spoke of her past. But dogs were a safe subject. McConney shook her head as Squidward rolled onto his back. "My mom claims she's allergic. Really, she just thinks they're too messy."
"We have a cat, too. She's probably outside right now."
"Sandy Cheeks?"
He grinned. "Raven."
"Ah, a much cooler name."
"Not necessarily. At the time, I had a massive crush on Raven Simone."
McConney laughed. Ollie rubbed Squidward's belly.
"I have no idea why my parents let me name our pets."
"Because clearly your parents were awesome." But she flinched as soon as it came out. Was it okay to mention them? Although he was the one who brought them up. And now he was nodding in agreement. It occurred to her that perhaps Ollie appreciated the acknowledgement of his parents. Perhaps it was harder when people went out of their way to avoid talking about them, when they pretended like his parents had never existed in the first place. McConney often pretended like hers didn't exist. At her grandmother's insistence, she called her mother once a week and her father every other week. They didn't even know what was happening here because, until this moment, she hadn't thought to tell them. Her parents always spent the two long calls complaining about each other. Ollie washed the dog off his hands and grabbed two burritos from the freezer. He held them up for her. They were both bean and cheese.
"One or two?"
McConney longed for a piping hot bowl of Simon, a noodle dish so common back home that it was on the menu at McDonald's.
Osborne didn't even have a non-Simon McDonald's, but burritos were decent, better than whatever she'd be making for dinner with her grandmother. "One, please," she said. "Thanks." He slipped off their wrappers, hesitated, and then grabbed another burrito for himself. All three went into the microwave. As she scratched behind Squidward's ears, Makani stared at a faded photograph on the refrigerator. Ollie's parents stood in front of Old Faithful. Their arms were around each other, and they were smiling as the geyser sprayed above their heads like a whale's blowhole. His father's smile was farmer stiff, but his mother looked carefree. Beside it was a photo of Ollie and his brother. Ollie looked old enough to be in high school, but he was still younger than she'd ever known him. His hair was an odd, streaky green, and he was wince laughing as Chris pulled him into a forced hug. She wondered if their parents were already dead, and who had taken the picture.
"I tried to dye it blue."
Like always, Ollie had been watching her.
"One of the first lessons that you learn in school, yellow and blue make green, and I forgot."
"You look like a mermaid. A sad, pubescent mermaid." Ollie froze, and then he covered his face, shaking his head in disbelief.
"That might be the actual worst thing that anyone has ever said to me."
"No!" As Makani burst into laughter, she smiled with all her teeth. "I mean, I stand by my assessment, but I swear, I have pictures that are just as bad, worse even."
"I demand proof."
"Fair enough. The next time you're at my house, take a peek under my bed." Ollie blinked, and then his eyebrows rose, perhaps at the mention of her bed. "Seventh grade swim team." Makani shuddered as she recalled her flat chest, gawky posture, and unflattering suit. "Let's leave it at that." The microwave let out an extensive series of beeps. As Ollie removed the steaming burritos, he glanced at her.
"You're a swimmer?"
Shit. She couldn't believe it had slipped out. Since the age of 7, she'd dived competitively, but her grandmother was the only person here who knew it. Osborne didn't even have a swim team, and even if it did, those days had passed. "I used to swim." She looked away, a little. Her eyes snagged on a brown file folder. It was sitting in the center of the breakfast table. She didn't have to open it to know what it contained. Ollie followed her gaze.
"See? He's practically asking me to read it."
"Why didn't he take it with him?"
"I'm sure he just forgot. Happens all the time."
The case file was thick. "Isn't a good memory kinda important for an officer?" Luckily, Ollie didn't take offense.
"That's why they write everything down. Cops do shit tons of paperwork." He shrugged. "Memories aren't reliable anyway."
Makani wished that she could forget. In the darkest hours of the night, her own memory was keen and cruel.
"You can look if you want." Ollie's voice tensed. "It isn't pretty."
Of course she wanted to look. Sheer human curiosity demanded it. But there would be no unlooking once she'd done it. Her fingertips crawled toward the file anyway. They recklessly flicked it open to reveal a stack of photographs and papers. A female body lay on her back, right arm hanging limp from a bed. Her neck had been carved open by 5 crude slices, 1 for the mouth, 2 for each eye, X and X. Dead cartoon eyes. In Makani's imagination, this scene, this smiley face, had been tidy and precise. But in reality, it was a bloodbath. The head was tilted too far back to see Haley's real eyes. The longest cut was deep and vicious, and her neck skin flapped open in a jagged, ugly gash,
Her hair, clothing, and bedsheets were soaked with enough blood to curdle a butcher's stomach. Blood had dried inside her nostrils. Makani closed the file with a shaking hand.
"Bad, right?" Ali said.
It wasn't just bad. It was horrific. A real dead body looked different from the ones on television or in the movies. There was nothing artful about it, nothing positioned. Haley's body looked lifeless, but not like life had been taken away from it, like it had never had life. Ali pressed his fingers to his temples.
"I should have warned you."
"You did." Makani hugged herself. Was Matt in that stack of photos, too? Or did he have a separate file? The brutality of the crime overwhelmed her. Someone did this. A real person had crept into Haley's house and murdered her in her own bed. "Any chance the police have a lead?" she asked. Ali shook his head.
"But they do think it's probably someone a lot smaller than Matt."
"So, not another football player?"
"Right."
"Why?" He waited for her to meet his eyes.
"Are you sure you want to know?"
Makani nodded.
"Before the killer did what they did, they stabbed Matt in the gut. But his abdomen had nothing to do with the final display of his brain. So he was probably attacked by someone who physically couldn't go straight for his head. They had to weaken him first, bring him down to their level."
Perhaps the killer was female after all. Dead cartoon eyes. Blood inside her nostrils. Makani became aware of a dinner plate being pushed gently against her stomach.
"Hey," Ali said. "It's nicer in my room."
She stared down at the warm plate. Was Matt stabbed once in the abdomen, or had it taken multiple jabs for him to go down? Wordlessly, she accepted the burritos. Ali carried their water glasses. As the stairs creaked beneath their feet, Makani wondered how many gruesome pictures he'd seen since his brother became a cop. Sure, there had never been deaths in Osborne this violent before, but people died by accident all the time. People like his parents. Did it get easier to look at the photos, or did it get harder, knowing that so many people died so young and in such awful ways? Did seeing the proof of this make you more paranoid or more careful? Or did it just harden you? Old photographs were everywhere. A framed studio portrait of his whole family hung at the top of the upstairs landing. Ali was so little that his mother held him on her lap. What was it like for him to look at this one every day?
"It's this one," he said, pulling the phrase from her mind.
Makani had assumed that his bedroom would be as black and unembellished as his wardrobe, so when he opened the door, she blinked in surprise. The room was filled with sunlight and signs of life. Even the kitchen clung to a whiff of abandonment, but here, Ali's ubiquitous paperbacks were spread across every surface. There were too many for his shelves, so they'd spilled onto his rug, been stacked on top of his desk and under it, and even lay in messy piles on his unmade bed. With its heap of mismatched blankets, the bed looked like the coziest spot in the entire house. Makani set down the plate on his desk and picked up the closest book, Jupiter's Travels. 4 years around the world on a triumph, she read aloud. On the cover, a man in an old-fashioned leather jacket rode an old-fashioned motorcycle. The paperback smelled old, too, like dusty shelves and faint mildew. She used it to gesture around the room. "I knew you liked to read, but wow." Ali shrugged with his hands in his pockets.
I get them from garage sales and the used bookstore in East Bend. I haven't read them all. I just keep picking them up.
I wasn't making fun of you. My last boyfriend read a lot, too.
Shit. Double shit.
Ollie wasn't her boyfriend. They barely knew each other. She wanted to know more about him. She wanted him to be her boyfriend. But they were each still standing behind a wall of unspoken history. She decided to act like she hadn't meant anything by it and casually picked up another book. Glanced at him. His pale skin was unable to hide an emotional flush. At least he didn't seem turned off by the idea. Makani had been surprised in Darby's car yesterday morning when she'd realized that Ollie was more shy than he was rebellious. But she was even more surprised now to realize that she found his shyness attractive. She held up a travel guide to Italy. "Mind if I go with you?"
"We'll leave tonight."
Ollie stepped toward her, and her heart spasmed. But he had only come closer to remove his keys from his pocket and take the plate to his bed. Disappointed, she flipped open the guidebook.
"Positano, Hotel Intermezzo."
Excellent value in this charming, family-run hotel overlooking the sea. She carried the book to his bed and plopped down beside him. "Shall I call for a reservation?" Ollie smiled as he bit into a burrito. He held out the plate with his other hand. She accepted one. It was strange, sharing a plate, but she liked it. It made her feel close to him.
"Tell me," he said.
Makani swallowed before speaking. The cheap burrito was thoroughly mediocre, but immensely satisfying. "Tell you what?"
"About your last boyfriend, the reader."
She smiled, caught. And then she nudged his leg with her kneecap, pleased by his obvious jealousy. "I thought I'd steered us away from that conversation."
"You tried. Usually you're good at that, at steering away."
It was the first time that it had been acknowledged out loud. She felt chastised, but rose to the challenge. "Okay, here's my offer. I'll tell you about my last boyfriend if you tell me about your last girlfriend." Ollie considered it for a few seconds.
"Deal."
Makani steeled herself to remain honest. "His name was Jason Nakamura, and we dated for 7 months. She tried to gauge Ollie's expression. It remained maddeningly enigmatic. "He was a swimmer, too. Freestyle.
But then he wouldn't talk to me anymore."
"But then I moved away."
"Did you try to make it work long distance?" Ollie asked.
She discarded her final bite back onto the plate, an end piece of freezer-hardened tortilla. "That would be a very long distance." When he waited for elaboration, she selected her next words carefully. "No. We didn't like each other enough." Ollie nodded with understanding. She braced herself. "Your turn. Last girlfriend." He set the plate onto the floor with a hollow clunk.
"No one."
It wasn't the answer she was expecting. She stared at him, searching for comprehension. He stared back as he repeated it.
"No one."
"Explain. Use more words." A smile tugged at his lips.
"I've never had a girlfriend."
Makani had made out with him. Makani had had sex with him. She found this statement to be highly improbable. He knew what she was thinking, and he shrugged. But it wasn't a shrug of indifference. It was a shrug that was hiding some measure of embarrassment.
"I've never had a girlfriend, but yes, obviously, I've had sex before you."
Makani couldn't let that one sit. "Obviously." Ollie squirmed and glanced up at the ceiling.
"Not obviously because I was amazing. obviously because... Oh, no. No, no, no. Her hair bounced as she shook her head. I need to hear you finish that sentence. His expression deadpanned.
Because I lasted more than 30 seconds.
She burst into raucous laughter, which made him smile. Ollie always smiled when he saw that she was happy. Makani leaned into the space between them.
So, are you going to tell me about this non-girlfriend?
Non-girlfriends? His smile widened into a grin.
Yes.
She moved in closer, beckoning.
But not today?
Their lips were an inch apart.
Not today, he said.
They went for each other at the same time. Mouths clashed, jackets peeled off. She lowered herself onto her back, and he moved above her, pressing down. The weight of his body made her feral. Her fingers clawed under his shirt and up his back as his hands slid over her bra. Her hands moved to the bottom of her shirt, ready to strip it above her head, when suddenly they were aware a third person was in the room.
Chapter 10. Chris stood in the doorway and swore, and then swore again.
Damn it, Ollie!
Ollie scrambled to sit up, scrambled to make sure that Makani was covered, even though they hadn't gotten that far.
What are you doing here?
His brother rubbed his forehead.
Nice to see you again so soon, Makani.
Her skin burst into flames as she shielded herself behind Ollie, who tried again.
Why are you home?
Chris dropped his hand and crossed his arms, drawing her eyes to the holster on his belt.
Chief sent me away to get some rest.
He glanced warily at the empty plate beside the bed.
When did you get here? Did you ditch again?
Ollie didn't reply.
Shit, Ollie, you can't do that.
Makani wished that she could run. She wished that she were anywhere but here.
We missed zero schoolwork, Ollie said. Nothing was happening. If nothing was happening, Chris said, then it shouldn't have been so hard to keep seated until the bell.
When Ollie tightened his mouth, Chris groaned and collapsed into the desk chair. He followed it with a long sigh.
Listen, there's a killer on the loose, and we don't know who or where he is. Or if he's even a he. That means your ass needs to be where it's supposed to be at all times. I need to know where you are.
Why? Ollie sounded remarkably incredulous for this reasonable request.
Because it's dangerous out there. They murdered the star of the musical and the star of the football team. Tell me what I have in common with those victims. You know that's not the point, shit, Chris said again.
He turned his attention to Makani.
You've got to stop hanging out with this kid. He's a bad influence.
Makani felt a wave of gratitude that he didn't view her as the bad influence. She ventured out from behind Ollie.
Does your grandmother know you're here? Chris asked.
She wanted to lie, but he was a cop.
No.
Chris shook his head. He picked up Ollie's keys from the desk and held them out, staring at the hardwood floor.
Ollie, drive her home.
Chris!
Ollie!
Ollie stomped over, snatched the keys in a way that made Chris wince, and then stalked out of his bedroom. Makani followed, but she glanced back to lift a hand in goodbye. Chris raised a weary hand in return.
Sorry, but I have to.
It was a strange thing for a parental figure to say, and it reminded her of the unnatural relationship that he'd been forced to play in his brother's life. In that moment, she felt sorry for Chris. Ollie hadn't made it easy for him. Then again, nothing about Ollie's life seemed to have been easy either.
That night, when Haley and the drama club were supposed to be in the middle of their first dress rehearsal, when Matt and the football team were supposed to be winning their final game of the season, Darby sent a text to Makani. "Can we talk?" She just finished loading the dirty dinner dishes into the dishwasher. Grandma Young was watching a Marvel movie in the living room. She didn't know that Makani had been to Ollie's house, and Makani planned to keep it that way. "Will Chris tell her?" she'd asked on the somber drive home. Ollie tried to assure her, despite the crease in his brow.
"I doubt it. His weakness is that he still wants to be my cool older brother."
To be safe, they made Saturday plans in full view of Grandma Young. He was going to come over before his shift at Greeley's. "I mean, phone talk?" Makani frowned at the second message. It was always ominous when someone asked to talk instead of text. She told her grandmother that she'd join her in a minute and waited until she was safely enclosed in her bedroom before hitting the call button. Darby picked up after the second ring.
"Thanks."
"Yeah, what's up?" An awkward silence followed.
Another bad sign.
"Darby?"
I just want you to know that as your friend, I love you, and that's why I'm telling you this."
Makani felt her body temperature drop. "Tell me what?"
"And you know I would never say this if it weren't important, if Alex and I weren't genuinely concerned."
"What, Darby?" He mumbled something rapidly that contained the name Ollie. A surge of hot anger replaced Makani's chill, but she tamped it down and asked him to repeat that last sentence. The accusation spewed forth in a torrent.
"Discounting rumors, it's still a fact that Matt and his friends have been bullying Ollie for years, and his alibi isn't strong for either murder, and we think he might be taking advantage of you. And Alex said I had to be the one to call because you'd just tell her to screw herself, or you'd think she was joking, but I swear we're not."
He took a breath.
"Not that we think he's guilty, but that was creepy how he got your phone number. You have to admit it."
Makani didn't have to admit anything. It was misguided and insulting.
"So what? You and Alex just sat there at the feed and seed all afternoon, selling cattle supplements and talking shit about me?"
"No!"
Darby sounded miserable.
"I'm sorry. We're worried about you."
"Yeah, you mentioned something along those lines yesterday, remember?" His voice dropped into a meek whisper.
"It didn't seem like you were listening."
Fury overtook her like an explosion from a pressure cooker.
"And what about Haley, huh? What did Haley ever do to Ollie? Why would he kill her?"
"In eighth grade, he asked her out and she said no. She was a seventh grader. He was humiliated. It wasn't long after his parents had died, and it was the last time I heard of him asking out someone from school until this weird thing with you."
It shocked her into speechlessness. She hadn't expected Darby to have a real answer, but it was still a colossal leap.
"Makani? Hello? Are you there?"
"That was 4 years ago." She forced her voice into a normal volume, despite the outrage swelling inside her again. "That's a long time to wait for a petty grudge."
"Just consider this. Ollie snubbed you for months. You guys hadn't talked since the end of summer. It's possible he might want revenge on you, too."
She sucked in her breath.
"Regaining your trust could be a part of his master plan."
"Master plan?"
"I only meant..."
"I was mad at him, too. It was mutual. A stupid misunderstanding."
"You're right. It's probably nothing."
Darby backed down to plead with her.
"But you have to understand that I could never live with myself if he turned out to be the bad guy and I'd kept my mouth shut."
Makani's indignation dissipated, flared back into raging life, and finally re-extinguished. Darby was trying to be a good friend. He was just getting it wrong. On paper, fine, Ollie looked suspicious. But he wasn't a murderer. She couldn't prove it. She just knew it. Ollie was shy and helpful, and he looked happy whenever she was happy. Darby's confrontation hurt because he was supposed to be the thoughtful friend. Alex was the impulsive one, and it confirmed her fears. They really did talk about her behind her back. Darby sounded distant through her buzzing eardrums.
Makani?
I appreciate your concern. It was a lie and not a lie. But you're wrong. And then she hung up. All night long, Makani tossed and turned. The house creaked like it was alive. Ollie. Haley. Ollie. Matt. Ollie. Me. All morning long, she ignored the apology texts from Darby and the jokey texts that acted as apologies from Alex. Ollie. Haley. Ollie. Matt. Ollie. Me. At noon, she was surprised to discover yesterday's shoes still at the bottom of the stairs. She grabbed them before Grandma Young could scold her. Ollie. Haley. Ollie. Matt. Ollie. No! Makani threw the sneakers hard onto her bedroom floor. Yesterday's socks were already lying beside the closet door, but the strangeness of this did not register to her. She had to believe that the mistakes of Ollie's past didn't guarantee that he would make even worse mistakes in his future. She had to believe that every mistake was still a choice. She had to believe that Ollie was a good person, because she had to believe it about herself. He arrived in the early afternoon. After the cycle of beverage options, they settled into the living room because, as Makani learned, it was against house rules to have a boy in her bedroom. As her friend, Darby was the only exception. Back in Hawaii, she'd spent plenty of time in her bedroom with her ex-boyfriend. Her parents either hadn't noticed or didn't care. The television was tuned to the closest physical station, which was broadcasting a basketball game. Neither Makani nor her grandmother followed the NBA, but Grandma Young was anxious to see the local news bumpers. Makani slouched beside her on the sofa while Ollie resumed his position in the easy chair. Ollie hadn't been kidding. He really did like jigsaw puzzles. A countryside harvest festival was spread across the coffee table, and its repeating autumnal patterns held him and Grandma Young in a matching trance. Perched on their seat edges, they bonded over etiquette and strategy. Start with the border. Then any sections that contain printed words. If someone is searching for one specific piece, but the other person finds it, it must be handed over, because it means more to the first person. And always save the sky, the hardest part of any puzzle, for last. Makani tried to join in, but the tediousness made her hungry, so she brought out snacks and ate snacks and brought out more snacks. She wondered if her ex would have entertained her grandmother without complaint. Before the incident, she would have said yes. Jason was wild, but she had been wilder. And he was a decent guy. He was also a coward who'd never bothered to ask for her side of the story. A coward who'd ignored her instead of dumping her outright. A coward who'd treated her like the highly contagious carrier of a deadly plague. Though in a way, she was. Makani was a social plague. She hated Jason for his cowardice, but she understood it.
You know, we've just been praying for their families day and night.
They looked up at the sound of the young country voice, a square-faced boy with a cross necklace and Lion Pride sweatshirt. The de facto spokesperson for the various local youth groups was on television. The text at the bottom of the screen read, Caleb Greeley, friend of the victims. The bumper cut to a blandly handsome man in a navy blue suit.
Osborne reacts to the slayings and to a killer still at large. Details at 6.
Creston Howard enunciated with the practiced air of a professional, managing to sound both solemn and upbeat. The basketball game resumed. Grandma Young turned to Ollie.
That was Pastor Greeley's boy, wasn't it?
Ollie nodded.
He works with me at the grocery store.
It was a familiar conversation, Ollie and her grandmother swapping information about mutual acquaintances. McConney hadn't recognized many of the names until now.
Oh, Greeley, she said. Caleb is related to the owner?
Caleb is the grandson of the original Mr. Greeley,
Ollie explained.
His uncle runs Greeley's Foods now.
And what does Caleb do there? Grandma Young asked.
Weekend supervisor.
McConney couldn't hear it in his tone, but she wondered if Ollie was bitter that Caleb was a supervisor when Ollie was the one who worked more hours. If it were her, she'd be bitter. Caleb wasn't actually a friend of the victims, was he?
Ollie smirked. As friendly as I was.
McConney nudged her grandmother. See? You have to turn off the news. It's not even telling you the truth.
You grieve in your way, Grandma Young said, and I'll grieve in mine.
Despite the outside world, their living room was at ease. McConney wondered why discussing a tragedy, consuming every single story about it, was often comforting. Was it because tragedies manifested a sense of community? Here we are, all going through this terrible thing together? Or were tragedies addictive, and the small pleasures that came from them the signal of a deeper problem? Ollie handed over a puzzle piece to Grandma Young. She exclaimed with delight and snapped it into place. They high-fived. No, McConney decided. It was impossible that this boy, who was so kind to her grandmother, could ever be a murderer. Chapter 11. There was a machete wedged behind the empty water cooler. He couldn't believe that someone had hidden it here, of all places. He yanked out the large plastic bottle and threw it at the woman, gaining the precious seconds necessary to reach back and fumble for the weapon. The bottle hit her head with a satisfying thunk. As she staggered, his hand clasped around the wooden handle. The machete came loose with just enough time to thrust it forward between her ribs. She fell against the copy machine. Planting his boot on her chest, he tugged out the blade before lifting it over his head and swinging it back down through her neck in a single swift motion. Her head splattered against the cubicle and then dropped into a recycle bin. He held out the machete to admire it. Yes, this will do nicely. But to keep it, he had to discard one of his other weapons, so he placed the tire iron behind the water cooler for someone else to find. That made him smile. Rodrigo Morales paused the game and tossed aside the controller. He took off his headphones, rubbed his eyes. It was midnight. His parents were carousing in Vegas for their silver wedding anniversary, and he wasn't about to let a single minute of this glorious weekend go to waste. He'd spent Friday night and all today fighting the zombies in Battleground Apocalypse with only one short nap, and he'd fight them all Sunday, too. He was the youngest of four children and the only son. His last sister had moved out in mid-August, and now, with his parents out of town, this was the first time in his entire life that he'd ever been truly alone. He relished it. Rodrigo stood, and his spine cracked from bottom to top. He rolled his neck in a methodical circle, stretched his arms toward the ceiling. "Wake up," he ordered himself. He slumped out of the living room and into the kitchen for an energy drink. It was a new brand, Jacked,
in aggressive all caps, and it came in a lurid green can. Despite the marketing campaign's flagrant promises, it wasn't better than any of the others. He'd been building up his tolerance for years.